State player on the Chicago Cubs opening day at Wrigley Field here on 720 WGN. So all Cubs fans know from heartbreak and curse-toting goats, few know that prior to moving to the North Side in 1916, the team fielded powerhouse nines that regularly claimed the pennant. Before the Ivy, a new book offers a grandstand seat to the Golden Age. It's called Before the Ivy, the Cubs Golden Age in Pre-Wrigley Chicago. And joining us this morning on Chicago Cubs opening day to talk about the team before they played at Wrigley is author Laurent Pernot, who's also the executive vice chancellor of the City Colleges of Chicago. Good morning to you, Laurent.
Good morning, David.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. You know, I know us diehard Cubs fans obviously know very well that the Cubs have not won a World Series since 1908. When they played though and won the World Series, they were playing on the West Side grounds of Chicago. But this team actually had a much earlier start, and it goes back to the early 1860s.
That's right. The game was thriving on a semi-pro basis in the 1860s, but in the late 1860s, early 70s, Chicago and a lot of the boosters in town decide that it's time for Chicago to go big time and go professional. There's a team called the Cincinnati Red Stockings. They are barnstorming across the country, making a big name for themselves, and Chicago doesn't like to be in Cincinnati's shadow.
No.
So they decide to start a professional team. And that team actually defeats the Red Stockings and becomes the biggest deal in the country. That ushers about a dozen pennants between 1870 and 1910, including obviously the last two World Series, which, as you said, were played on the West Side. Before that, they played downtown where Millennium Park is today. And they actually play on the South Side near a place that you may have heard of. It's the site of the where the White Sox are today, actually.
Wow. Now, I know, you know, there were other ball clubs, too. There was the Excelsior Ball Club. You mentioned the Chicago Actives, the Evanston Gazelles. The Excelsior Ball Club was probably the earliest. It was formed in 1857, and it's fascinating to know that they went away because of the Civil War. You know, they were disbanded at the time. But in 1871, the Chicago White Stockings were formed 1 year before the Great Chicago Fire. It was a different ball club at the time. A fire destroyed the original ballpark. It was called Lake Park, as you said, where Millennium Park stood today. All their uniforms, all their equipment was gone. But then in 1874, a new Chicago White Stockings were formed, and that eventually became the Cubs.
That's right. And the the boosters in town, a lot of the folks, including William Hulbert, who ends up starting the National League, he's a member of the Board of Trades. So a lot of the top business leadership in town decides that it's time for Chicago to have a baseball team again. The team didn't play for 2 years after the fire. The Tribune repeatedly wrote that the city had bigger and better things to do, rebuilding itself. But after a couple of years, people say, okay, this is time for Chicago to be big time again. And as a sign of the city's resurgence, it's time to start playing baseball. So William Hulbert starts the National League, and he's president of the Chicago White Stockings, who actually win the first inaugural pennant in 1876 for the National League.
Wow. He was a really impactful guy in baseball, period. I know he was very late. He was very much a latecomer, getting inducted into Cooperstown, into the Hall of Fame. But, you know, not only an impact for baseball in general, as you said, creating the National League, but, I mean, obviously he kind of built up what the Cubs are, you know, today.
Yes, and few people know him, really, or his story. And like you said, it took a while for him to get into the Hall of Fame. A great trip for Cubs fans is to go to see his grave. It's at Graceland Cemetery, which is right by Wrigley Field. And there's a stone baseball on his grave.
I've seen it. It's awesome.
It's a pretty cool sight. So it's Cap Anson's grave. We haven't talked about Cap yet, but Cap Anson is buried on the South Side, and he obviously has made probably more of a mark on the team than just about anyone else. He still holds most Cubs records about 100 years after having retired, and really carried the team through the 1880s, where they had by far the best starting lineup in baseball at the time. They win five titles in the 80s. But he also, Cap Anson, that is, ends up really having a big stain on his record, because he's very active in keeping not only the team all white, but keeping the league free of black players. He was he and Al Spalding are very, very active in keeping blacks out of the major leagues, and unfortunately were very effective at doing that and kept them out for, we know, until the 40s. But in the 1880s, a lot of black players are actually starting to break through, but Chicago refuses to play against team fielding black players, and that ends up sealing the fate of black players for several decades.
You were mentioning Spalding. Pitcher Albert Spalding was, you know, obviously a notable player in the 1800s, but, you know, when Hulbert, William Hulbert, as you mentioned, passed away, Spalding assumed ownership of the team, but he also started Spalding Sporting Goods, which is still around today.
Spalding's an amazing guy. He really kind of built baseball as we know it. And one of the reasons he did that was he understood it was good for business. It was a good way to move his sporting goods. He starts a store here downtown in the Loop is his flagship store. He also has Spalding's Almanac, which we all know, and really is the guy who develops baseball as big business. He early on with Spalding decides this is not supposed to be a player-driven sport, but it's supposed to be an owner-player-driven sport, and he really makes his mark that way on the game.
Well, I'll tell you what, the White Sockings officially became the Chicago Cubs in the 1907 season, the first season they won the World Series, and we'll talk about that next with author Laurent Pernot in his new book, Before the Ivy, The Cubs' Golden Age in Pre-Wrigley Chicago, after the news next on 720 WGN. Michael, I don't know you play the organ. Quite incredible. State player on opening day on Chicago Cubs baseball on this Easter Sunday morning on 720 WGN. And we're talking to author Laurent Pernot in his new book, Before the Ivy, The Cubs' Golden Age in Pre-Wrigley Chicago. So, Laurent, the White Stockings, they were nicknamed the Cubs in 1902 by the Chicago Daily News. Why the Cubs?
So, as you said, they went through several names, and it's really the papers that are driving names, and they're called the Remnants for a while. And this is kind of interesting because in 1901, a bunch of the players, not just from the Cubs, but from the National League, leave to play for the new American League. And so they're the Remnants, and that's on the heels of about 12 years of being fairly horrible. L. Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz, he lives right by West Side Grounds and writes a poem about what a pretty wretched experience it is to be a Cubs fan, really. But in 1901, they have a horrible season, and I think that's the greatest message of hope for Cubs fans. I think 1901 hopefully will be our 2012, and I'll tell you what I mean by that.
Okay.
Both years were below 400, and in 1902, the Cubs say, okay, enough is enough. They bring a new player called Frank Seeley, a new manager called Frank Seeley, and he brings in guys called Tinker, Evers, and Chance. And Chance is a kind of an older guy by then. He's a catcher who's never really taken off, but he's being repurposed at first base, which turns to be a really good move for him. But Tinker and Evers are both very, very young. So the papers start calling the team the Cubs because the players are so young.
Okay.
The name starts getting used in the papers, but doesn't really take off until 1907, and that's when it gets used on a more permanent basis. The reason for that is the Cubs are owned by a guy named Charles Murphy, and he's obviously Irish. So the Tribune for a few years calls the team the Spuds. In fact, when the Cubs are playing the White Sox for the ill-fated 1906 World Series, the Tribune calls it the Sox Spud Series. But, you know, in 1907, Frank Chance, who's the obviously part of the great triple play trio and also by then the player manager, asks the papers to call the team the Cubs, and the name sticks. So the first time they win the World Series, they truly win the World Series as the Cubs.
Now, what's funny, you mentioned Charles Murphy. There's only been, and this is was very surprising to me, I mean, when we're really talking about the origins of this team going back to the 1870s, that there's only been 10 owners of the team. So, you know, William Hulbert was the first one, Albert Spalding, James Hart, Charles Murphy, you said 1905, Charles Taft in 1914, Charles Wegman in 1916, the Wrigley Company in 21, the Tribune Company in 81, and then Sam Zell for 2 years, and then the Ricketts family. I mean, it's been a pretty tightly held team.
It really has, and a very profitable one. And I think one of the greatest legacies may have been profitable losers. I think Spalding is the one who really figures that one out. He actually does a wholesale liquidation of the teams in the 1890s, and they go on to lose for about 10 straight years, but the team is making a fair amount of money at that time. But Murphy has a whole different philosophy. A, he really believes in winning, but B, he figures out that they can make even more money if they win, and lo and behold, they do win.
Now, this is also pretty fascinating because obviously this is all about pre-Wrigley Chicago. The Cubs played in no less than 7 ballparks. 1870 was Dexter Park on the corner. There was a ton of baseball fields all around Chicago at the time. I mean, this is, you know, we know our two major fields in Wrigley and the Cell, but there were baseball fields everywhere.
Especially in we talked about the 1860s. Halsted Street is just about the countryside at that point, so you don't have to go very far to go play baseball because at that time, it's considered a country sport. Dexter Park was actually a racetrack. People would go there when the team was not playing. People would go there to engage in pigeon shooting. That was a very popular sport at the time. And it's a racetrack, and the Cubs play there. But they eventually get their own dedicated ballparks. And the first title that they win in 1876 is actually at the place called 23rd Street Grounds, which is on the south side at 22nd and State.
And that was one of the ones that they played at the longest, because then there was Lakefront Park, which is same location as Lake Park, which is Michigan Avenue and Randolph. There was West Side Park for about 5 years, bounded by Congress, Throop, Loomis, and Harrison Streets. 1891 was the Brotherhood Park, which was the South Side Grounds, and then the West Side Grounds in 1894 to 1915. So that was the largest time frame. Where was the West Side Grounds at the time?
So West Side Grounds is right on the site of the U of I School of Medicine is today, so just south of Cook County Hospital. And yes, that's where they play the longest span, and it had great public transportation, which is why I think it was so successful. As a location for them.
But it took almost 46 years to get to Wegman Park, which is now Wrigley Field, but they played that long, 46 years, in other ballparks before they even got to Wrigley.
Yes, and won about a dozen pennants and 2 World Series in the process. So, you know, some have said that I've talked to, and that's the conclusion I came to. You got to wonder if the curse is about a goat or whether it's just a really curse.
the field itself, yeah. So you got the 1907 World Series, the 1908 World Series against the Tigers. Harry Steinfeld was a big player in the World Series, batting .470, and then 1910. After a 104-win season, the team is outscored 35-15 as it falls 5 games to the Philadelphia Athletics, and it was kind of a downward spiral from there.
Yeah, well, at that moment, we haven't really talked about Tinker, Evers, and Chance much, but these guys are winding down at that moment. Their careers all are coming to the end at the same time. Steinfeld, who is kind of the unheralded fourth leg of that triple play combination, also is coming to the end of his career at that moment. And so, the team's departure from West Side Grounds up to Wrigley kind of coincides with that. It's really a merger, by the way. Up on the north side in this new stadium, we have the Chicago Whales playing. And they actually outdraw the Cubs, and the Whales actually win the Federal League title. And at that time, the Cubs are not playing well and not drawing. And so the teams really merge into one. And we often think of the Cubs moving north, but it's really a merger of the two teams.
Yeah, that's what I always thought. I thought the Whales moved out and the Cubs moved in. But you're saying that these two things, because it was Albert Lasker, who he was an advertising executive who bought a lot of the club shares before, you know, between 1914 and 1916. He brought in Charles Wegman. He was a big restaurant guy, wasn't he?
He was, but he eventually goes bankrupt, which ushers in the arrival of Wrigley as the main player on the ownership front.
Gotcha. So the Chicago Whales and the Cubs merged with one another. The Federal League, was that disbanded by that point?
Yes.
Okay. And they won a dozen pennants, you know, on the South and West side. You're saying from 1870 to 1916. And then finally making its way over to Wrigley Field.
Yes. What's interesting that few people know, obviously it's interesting to know they were playing on the west side, but it's how interwoven the team's history is with Charles Comiskey. Obviously, he takes their old name. They use Chicago White Stockings for about a decade, and then, you know, they start using other names. So when he starts his American League franchise in 1901, he decides that he'd better repurpose the name because it's pretty popular and obviously heavily associated with baseball in Chicago. So he shortens it to White Sox. His team ends up playing at the old site of the Cubs. And obviously in 1906, we have the conflagration between the Cubs and the Sox. And, you know, at that time, the Cubs have the best record in baseball, not only that year, but ever. And they come to play what's known as the Headless Wonders. A lot of people are overlooking the fact that the White Sox have won 19 straight games to come into the World Series, and the Sox defeat the Cubs. And one writer for the Tribune writes that the Cubs looked like they had a case of the rickets at the plate, which is a kind of an interesting...
It sure is.
Kind of an interesting expression, and we can only hope that maybe this rickets finds a cure for the rickets that the Cubs have had for about a century.
Well, you were saying earlier that, you know, hopefully what happened in the early 1900s was our 2012, which will hopefully kick off some great baseball this season and next.
Well, 1901, they have one of their worst records ever, 377. 381, I'm sorry. 377 was their record in 2012. 1901, they're really at the bottom. And by 1903, they're winning. And by 1906, they are in the World Series. And they win in 07. They win in 08. And they go back in 1910 and don't make it. I want to go back to Comiskey, if I can, for a second.
Sure.
So everyone knows, unfortunately, that the Sox still have bragging rights for beating us in 06. But Comiskey also beats the Cubs in 85 and 86. That's 1885 and 1886. The Cubs win the National League, but there's a rival major league, and they decide to challenge the Cubs for a postseason series. And Charles Comiskey plays. He's manager and player on the St. Louis Browns. And they beat the Cubs. So the Cubs win the National League in 85-86, but do lose the national and title to the Browns and Charles Comiskey. So Charles Comiskey really was their main rival there for about 20 years.
Wow. Wow. Well, I'll tell you something, Laurent. It's an incredibly fascinating book. I mean, we only, touched on a couple of the highlights. There are some amazing, amazing photographs that you've researched and put in this book as well. And the book is called Before the Ivy, The Cubs' Golden Age in Pre-Wrigley Chicago, available at Amazon.com, wherever books are sold on this opening day at Wrigley. Laurent Pernot, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Let's go get one.
Let's go get one. All right. Go Cubbies. Much more ahead on 720 WGN.